From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore the misconceptions around human trafficking and how it can hinder prevention. Then we'll learn about this year's Milwaukee Short Film Festival, which is screening 55 films over 2 days, most with a common theme.
This year, it was clear that the films I was selecting had a very Wisconsin sensibility about them, more so than previous years.
Plus, we'll look at a book that explores the politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Part of what superhero films generally do is exercise a kind of conservative small c approach, which is to sort of keep what was good.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. There are many misconceptions about what human trafficking looks like and who can be a victim. Those preconceptions can prevent systemic change that could protect people from being trafficked. Dr. Sarah McKinnon is an associate professor in rhetoric, politics, and culture at UW-Madison. She's an expert on immigration and refugee issues, gender-based violence, and international global politics. She joins me to help break down the stereotypes surrounding human trafficking. And a note to our listeners, this conversation includes the topic of sexual violence. When we're specifically talking about human trafficking, our minds go to these long-standing imagery campaigns that you see on commercials, for example, or on posters at bus stops, this narrative of someone being snatched away. So what's the context of this long-standing imagery we associate with this issue, at least here in America?
I mean, there is a long-standing history that I think is important to understand. So if we think about U.S. immigration laws, some of the earliest immigration laws were actually about trafficking. There was this fear that white women would be trafficked into the United States or trafficked out of the United States. And so they were called the white slavery laws. And so that idea, I think, undergirds a lot of discussions and imagery about trafficking today. And it's very different than the reality of trafficking in the contemporary context.
Right. So let's get into that. What are some of the key preconceptions about human trafficking that are simply wrong?
Yeah. So one misperception is that the primary perpetrators of trafficking are men. Yes, men are perpetrators of trafficking, but women are absolutely involved in trafficking of other individuals as well. So that's one misconception. There's another misconception that it primarily happens over or international borders. And that's a misconception that's also false. Trafficking happens within countries as well. And that's a really significant dynamic to consider and make sense of. There's a misperception that trafficking is largely about sex trafficking. And while sex trafficking is an important component of the landscape of trafficking, it's certainly not the only reason why trafficking happens. And then lastly, there's a sense that trafficking happens just like you described, by someone snatching an individual from the streets or from a place and effectively kidnapping them and putting them into a trafficking circle. The reality is that most traffickers groom their trafficking victims, and so there's a process of grooming that goes with that. It could even be someone that someone knows for a while in terms of the dynamic. And so those are some large narratives and misperceptions about trafficking that can make it then challenging to actually effectively address trafficking from a policy standpoint.
You mentioned our loose understanding or labels and definition is impeding policy changes or helping to address this properly. So how else does the, not just the imagery, but the rhetoric and language used around human trafficking harmful to survivors?
Because there is a disconnect between the vision or the narrative of trafficking and then the reality of trafficking, it means that the policy that's in place doesn't really address or target where trafficking is primarily happening. And so we don't, for example, get a lot of attention paid to the agricultural industry and the prevalence of trafficking in that industry when we're talking about trafficking. This is a place where you know, this happens because there's so much attention to sex trafficking. There's so much attention to trafficking of youth that adult men, for example, aren't considered a part of the picture of trafficking. So this is, that's, I think, one place where we can really see that happen. In terms of like policy related to immigration, the United States does have protections in place for victims of trafficking, immigration protections. So contexts where someone can apply for basically a non-immigrant visa and then later a permanent residency. But in order to do that, the individual has to be working with law enforcement to address the context of trafficker. So typically it's law enforcement that would bring someone's name forward for these visas, either the U visa or the T visa. And they have to be working with law enforcement to address it. And the reality is a lot of people who are trafficked are just not in a context where they feel secure enough or even have access to law enforcement in order to make that happen. And then there's a lot of fear of what that means to continue to communicate and participate in the, you know, in the criminal trial, for example, or in what, you know, the sentencing, the processing. So that becomes another challenge for individuals to receive protections.
Another thing where I think there's a lot of confusion is the difference between trafficking and smuggling. Can you get into that a little more?
Yeah. And I'll say at the outset that it's much blurrier. The line between trafficking and smuggling is much blurrier than the vision of it, especially in the contemporary context. But for a loose definition, we can say that trafficking happens when someone is put in a context of force for work situation. So there's a lack of consent to that. That context of consent is really important. The force is really important. Smuggling happens when someone pays an individual to move them across borders. And smuggling is typically in a context of across international borders. So in the context of immigration today, especially in the United States, and especially as we're thinking about the Americas, a significant portion of individuals who ultimately may arrive at the U.S. Mexico border to apply for asylum probably have had to work with a smuggler at some point to make that movement. Just because of the context of immigration today, it's really hard to move across international borders without some guidance. Criminal organizations are now highly involved in that process and insist that migrants pay them to move across those borders. And so individuals who are using a smuggler, who kind of are in this industry, are highly precarious to human trafficking as well. And so this is a dynamic that I think is important to consider, that connection between trafficking and smuggling.
So there's a lot of discussion of the prevalence of trafficking for immigrants. What forms of trafficking are most prevalent for immigrants and refugees, especially in the United States here?
Yeah, so I had mentioned that the agricultural industry is really significant in this context because of who is arriving to as a laborer in the United States. But most recently, there's been a lot of attention paid to the experiences of unaccompanied minors that were a part of the kind of immigration reforms and policy implementations since 2014. So Central American unaccompanied minors. And one of the things that some investigative reporting has recently uncovered is that a lot of youth that are in the program for unaccompanied minors who now are living with a sponsor in the United States are actually very young, 14, 15, and working in some of the US's biggest corporations. So the cereal that you eat right now may have been packaged by an unaccompanied minor who is now working, going to school during the day and then working at night. And so there were some reports, particularly by the New York Times about a month ago, that really shed light on this context. And the question arises, is this force? Is this voluntary? And so here is another moment where we can see some of the blurry lines between smuggling, trafficking, consent, force, some of these dynamics that make it really hard to address through policy the realities of the situation.
So I'm learning more about all the nuances and the issues now that crosses gender, ages. Can you share some context on how human trafficking has traditionally been viewed and handled in the United States? Like, for example, gender's not a category in the UN refugee definition that the US uses to evaluate asylum seekers' claims. So how have we treated refugees fleeing gender-related persecution or when it's related to human trafficking?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, the conversation about asylum and trafficking have been quite separate. There are separate immigration protections in the United States, although certainly victims of trafficking can apply for asylum. It's typically not that they are applying for asylum because they've been trafficked. They're applying for asylum because they flee persecution in their home country and are seeking refugee protection on those grounds. And so in some ways, I think that's one of the challenges, that these programs have been quite separate. And it's interesting because there is a lot of attention paid to sex trafficking in the United States, a lot of concern, a lot of policy work around that. And yet when we look at the context for women who are fleeing gender-based violence in their home country. So in this context, I'm talking about rape and sexual assault by military officials or police, decade-long experiences of intimate violence at the hands of one's husband, in a context where you can't go to the police and say, you know, please help me. You can't expect that a judge will say, yes, you can divorce your husband. These are just not contexts that are possible. A range of other types of gender-based violence. So the context is such that for asylum seekers fleeing that form of these forms of violence, gender-based violence, there really aren't a lot of protections. And so we have a lot of attention paid to sex trafficking. But when a woman who is fleeing gender-based violence comes to a U.S. official and says, I can't return to my home country, I will experience violence, I fear persecution, the U.S.'s answer has been largely to turn their backs to women fleeing gender-based violence.
There's this obvious disconnect. What else is holding us back from taking gender-based violence seriously? You know, is it our frame of reference that we look at when it comes to this?
I think there are a number of things that are playing out, but I think with gender-based violence in particular, it's sticky because U.S. policymakers, U.S. officials cannot say that gender-based violence doesn't happen in this country, right? When one in four women are sexually assaulted and will experience intimate violence at some point in their lives. And so that dynamic, I think, is really challenging when someone arrives at the U.S. border and says, I am fleeing this form of violence in my country, please give me refuge. Because if U.S. officials were to, then perhaps the mirror would have to be turned back on the national context. The other dynamic, and this is kind of more of my suspicious lens coming into play, but I also believe it's about a fear of Black and brown bodies and the fear of reproductivity and the changing face of the US nation. That if we were to say as a country that fleeing intimate violence and sexual assault, these are forms of persecution that we will recognize as political persecution, then that would really give space for many, many women around the world to arrive and seek protection on those grounds. And in my research, always at the base of the kind of politicians' ideas about gender-based violence and immigration protections, there is a concern about the fear of brown and black reproductivity and the fear of the changing face of the US nation. So in many ways, this is about whiteness. I think that's a really significant analysis to overlay, especially when we look at the trajectory of some of these protections.
Well, Sarah, I want to thank you so much for helping us break some of this down. I know there's so much more to discuss, but thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Dr. Sarah McKinnon is an associate professor at UW-Madison, and she joined me last year. In about 10 minutes, we'll get a preview of this year's Milwaukee Short Film Festival coming up this weekend. But first, we'll go behind the scenes at the Milwaukee Public Museum to learn about the artifacts in the geology collection that aren't normally on public display. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Milwaukee Public Museum has more than 4 million artifacts in its collections. Many of these items either haven't been displayed or have only been viewable during certain exhibitions. If you head to the geology department in the basement of the current museum space, you'll find many artifacts that have never been seen on the museum floor. There are many reasons for that, as Patricia Kura-Burke explains. She's the curator of the geology collection, and she led WUWM's Joy Powers and Eddie Morales through a vast room that holds fossils, minerals, and rocks for our series, Behind the Scenes at MPM. They explore some of the collection from the Milwaukee Formation, a geological formation in Milwaukee County that contains fossils from the time when the land now known as Wisconsin was located deep below the water near the equator.
Okay, so we are entering the geology storage area of the Milwaukee Public Museum. This area houses most of our early Paleozoic rocks, all of the minerals, and some of our vertebrate collection. And it is pretty much full to the ceiling. So just to give you a sense of what's going on here.
It is crazy just how much is in this space.
So one of my projects for the past 10 years has been to move our handwritten collection records from those old catalog books that you might see in, you know, weird places like libraries, or we're moving that information into our collection management system. And I've had grants from the Institute of Museum and Library Services to do that. So I've gone from the Silurian, was my first grant, and as that grant started, we started to realize that we might be moving to a new facility. So as part of that project, I added on a little, to make it easier to move, we tried to give every specimen a digitally readable label. So everything should have, most things have a QR code, and every drawer has a QR code. So when it's time to move, they should be able to scan the drawer, know what's in it. Let's knock on wood that actually happens. You know, there's a lot of things here. So things would be easy to get lost. So that was our project. So we went from the Silurian, which is about 420 million years old. That's when the ancient reefs were really dominant around Milwaukee along the coast. Then we went to the Ordovician, which is a little older, and did that, and now we are working on the stuff very close to Milwaukee, the Devonian, and that is the Milwaukee Formation, which you guys have probably heard about. And some of the cool things that you can find in the Devonian are fish. We have fish material that people don't think of that far back as having fish, and they certainly don't think of Milwaukee as being a place where you're going to find fish fossils. A lot of this material was salvaged when they were digging the new intake tunnel. The city of Milwaukee was digging a new intake tunnel, and that went under Lake Michigan, out pretty far out into Lake Michigan. As they tunneled, the material got pulled back and piled just to the north of UWM, I think is where the piles were. And so there was this very ambitious young man who was growing up on the west side, Gilbert Rosch, and he would take the trolley every weekend when he was in high school, went over to those piles, went through and collected a lot of this material. And so we actually, it's actually a legacy of Gilbert Rosch that we have this material. He went on to UW-Madison to get a PhD in geology, but he was very close to the curators here, and he his collection ended here.
What year did most of this come into the collection?
I would say the 1930s, because he actually got a stipend for giving this to MPM, and he used that to pay to go to college. So it's actually sort of a cool story, this kid growing up on the West Side, taking the trolley to collect all this stuff, and he knew all of this stuff.
You mentioned a little bit about like the efforts to digitize it and to organize it. Can you talk about, is that different across different departments? Some of what's going on here with the QR codes, or is that kind of standard across different departments?
Well, there's a standardization, but like each department has their own data that needs to be put in. Like, for instance, in geology, we have a collection event, but we also have to know what layer of rock this material was collected from. Remember I said geologists give every layer of rock a name? So if we look at this, you can see that the rock layer was the Milwaukee Formation. And then we even dice it a little more, and we call it the Bertholet member. So there, we split that one layer into parts. So other departments don't need that information. So each department has their own information that needs to go into the data management system. But we're all using catalog numbers as our essential record.
Now, looking at these, I'm seeing kind of a red outline.
That was drawn on so you could follow what you're seeing. And so this would have been a part and a counterpart of this fish.
Okay.
So let me see if I can get it to go back. I don't like to play with it too much because it scrapes up the, yeah, I can't quite get it. But so when he found this rock, probably tapped it, split it open, and it split into these two halves. And you can see, and there's even, you know, you can see them, it's sort of the fin material right there.
It's amazing what's in these, because I'm like, as we're looking at this, I can see kind of the outline of the fossil, and as you mentioned, like a piece of fin, but then I'm also seeing what to me looks like a crystal almost.
And that's what it is. That is what it is. So this would have been a void where groundwater percolates through and fills in these spaces. So this is calcite, and the other mineral that's frequently found in the Milwaukee Formation is millerite, which is this very, a lot of times it's this just like thread thin needle of mineral.
We're looking at this one drawer. We are in a room full of these drawers. Why do items like this end up down here in a drawer versus up in the museum on display?
Well, I mean, take a look at it. If you just walked up to this display, would you know that this was a fin, this was some special fish? So there's only so many things you can display and relate any information about those things. The other part is that some of these things are down here in this drawer, but they're used by scientists. So some of this material was used just a few years ago in a paper that just looking at the fish from the Devonian. So that's one aspect of it. The other, which is sort of important now, is that as we've advanced in our ability to analyze things, people can take something that has a little bit of a fish fin and they can analyze, you know, what is making that up down to the molecular level. So there's a lot more we can learn from these now with our testing and our imaging techniques than we could have in 1930, or we could have even in 1990. Some of this is preserved for scientists to do things that we don't even know we can do yet. Those things are, you know, waiting for us to figure out.
Patricia Kura-Burke is the curator of geology collections at the Milwaukee Public Museum. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and WUWM reporter Eddie Morales for our series Behind the Scenes at MPM. At WUWM.com, you can find more of their conversations about the museum's many collections. The Milwaukee International Short Film Festival is the longest-running film festival that honors local filmmakers. This year, 90% of its lineup is presented by Wisconsin filmmakers, including 51 Milwaukee premieres. With films, events, and panels that celebrate everything from comedy to horror and local filmmakers of color, there's plenty to see over the two-day festival. Milwaukee Short Film Festival founder and director Ross Bigley joins me now to share more and begins by explaining the theme that naturally emerged this year.
Well, every year when I program the festival, and after I watch all the films, I kind of see if there's films that complement each other. And you can see a theme building. They can complement each other through themes, through similar plots, through, you know, just doing the same subject matter, but in a different perspective. And this year, it was clear that the films I was selecting had a very Wisconsin sensibility about them, more so than previous years.
Yeah, so can you share some of that Midwestern sensibility or themes that made you feel that way?
Well, we generally have a way of looking at things, and we have a certain sense of humor about things, too. And, you know, we always have had, especially in the past few years, a strong bent on having local films. We try to get as many in as possible, and this year we have a lot, like 90% is local. Yet sometimes the local filmmakers are trying genres or subject matters that might not feel Wisconsin-like. And this year was clearly evident that when you watch a film, it's like, oh, that feels like it was made in Wisconsin. It was done by people in Wisconsin and all that.
And of course, with this being an election year and a lot is happening in the moment, did films reflect either the politics or themes of modern day American life?
Yes. We try not to be overtly political in the festival because you never know who's coming in to watch the film, and you don't want to scare them off to come back to see another festival. But certain topics were just not avoidable, considering what people's fears might be after this year. One film, Safety State, is a film about a couple of LGBTQ people who fake being married and straight because the state that they live in is going to have a ban on gay marriage. So they're fleeing the state, which is, who knows what might happen with the Supreme Court and everything, you know? So they're looking at how things might affect their lives, and they're making films about that.
Another genre that's becoming increasingly popular over the last few years is horror. Did you find this to be reflected in this year's submissions?
Yeah, we generally do play a horror film or two, but this year we've had an overabundance of horror. We have a panel, today's horror genre, where we actually had filmmakers from our festival on that panel, Savannah Warble and Cassie Lanas and Corey Powers. And each of their films, Locksmith, Lost Boy Pizza, and Lurker, are playing in the festival. And we're trying to get why horror seems to be on a strong emergence in terms of the genre in which they're choosing to tell their story. Because much like science fiction, you can tell different sorts of ideas in horror. And people might be willing to accept that idea because it's being filtered through a horror idea or a science fiction idea, that type of thing. So you're kind of letting people in easy into what your thoughts are, but it's still giving a visceral thrill as well.
Yeah, kind of have more flexibility and a bigger invitation through that creativity.
Yeah. And Michael Byers is the moderator of the horror panel. He does the Shameless Picture Show.
So you mentioned a film like Safety State, a couple of the horror films being featured. What else, in your opinion, are some of the most anticipated festival favorites for this year?
I don't program to what my tastes are, but I really enjoyed When You Hear Your Pizza by Tim Schwagel. That I found to be a very hilarious film about a man who eats pizza every day from a certain restaurant. And one day he decides to make a change in his life, and that restaurant doesn't take kindly to it. There is The Avon Lady by Caroline Espiro, which stars her mother as an immigrant coming to this country. And she is using selling Avon door to door as trying to integrate herself into the community and learning English and learning what it means to be an American and all that. There's Locksmith. I really enjoyed Corey Powers' film. I thought it was well made. There's so many films and different genres, different types of storytelling in this that I think if you don't like one, the next one you'll probably enjoy. We always, this year more than ever, have tried to make it easier for people determining if you like a comedy, we're showing you which films are comedies and which times they're playing in. If you like drama, that type of thing. So you'll be able to kind of hopefully navigate where your tastes lie and which block you want to see.
This year also marks the 9th season of spotlighting the work of local filmmakers of color through Voices Heard. Can you share a bit more about some of the first-time events that are happening?
Well, Voices Heard is a program we created 9 years ago because we found that there wasn't an avenue or any sort of kind of venue going on for local filmmakers of color. Yes, we do get films by filmmakers of color outside of Wisconsin, and many film festivals do program those films, but it seems like they were not looking at the local angle. And so we developed this program, and over years it's grown. We've included live performances as well and made it more of a cultural thing where you can have, there was dance last year. There was fashion 1 year with local people of color fashion designers. So we've always tried to kind of broaden it a little bit in terms of what we can do within that block of time. And this year we're bringing back poetry, which was the first live performance we've done with Voices Heard. The poets are Mario the Poet Willis, Moe Shigeti, and King Kamanzi.
And this year you're also having the first ever panel discussion for Being a Filmmaker of Color in Milwaukee, right?
Yes. It's called Being a Filmmaker of Color in Milwaukee and what it means to be one in Milwaukee. And have they seen anything that might have changed over the course of them being a filmmaker of Milwaukee? Because there are still some roadblocks. And hopefully they can shed some light on it. It's being moderated by Sammy Amand, who is also the host for the rest of Saturday. And it features local filmmakers, actors in this area, Q. Davis Lay, who's in quite a few films on Tubi right now. One of them is Untangled. Therese G., who has a film in our festival, Desire. Casey Kelsey also is in our film festival. She has a film, The Kingdom Call. And J. Anthony Ramos, who's had films in our festival for previous years, is part of this panel as well. And we hope there will be a very fascinating discussion on where they think things were and how they are now.
Well, whether it's through panels or the short films or the many events around it, there's plenty for people to choose from. And Ross, I want to thank you so much for joining me to share more about this year's Short Film Fest.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed being here.
Ross Bigley is the founder and director of the Milwaukee Short Film Festival, which will be held at the Avalon Theater in Bayview September 7th and 8th. WUWM is one of the sponsors of the festival. We'll take one more break and then examine a book on the politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Like Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Marvel movies have been dominating global screens for more than a decade. But what do these films say about our culture? And perhaps more importantly, what are these films teaching this global audience? A book called The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is exploring the cultural impact and, of course, the politics espoused in these films. Dr. Lily Gorin is an author and editor of the book, and she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about it.
So when you look at the major films made over the last couple decades, it's really astounding how many of them are from the cinematic universe, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. How impactful are these films?
What is interesting about the Marvel Cinematic Universe itself is the impact is substantial in terms of dollars and cents. The Marvel Cinematic Universe as an entity makes more money than about 35 countries in the world have gross domestic product. And so when you start thinking about sort of movies in those terms and how much they cost to make, and you're talking about a $300 million film to make, then it makes over $1 billion in 5 days. Those numbers are kind of interesting to explore in terms of impact on people and sort of how the narratives worm their way into our thinking.
I think sometimes we think about comic books and hero films as being for kids, but that's really not the case. We see kids go to these films. We, of course, see parents go to these films, but then everyone else in between. They're huge, and not just here in the United States, but internationally. When I think about these films, I don't necessarily relate them to politics, which, as I read the book, you know, seemed odd, because so many of the books are dealing with things, albeit extraordinary, that in a normal setting would be handled in the political arena. What makes these films political? What are the attributes that are really about politics?
Well, again, you know, the sort of basic narrative of a superhero movie or television show, you have some sort of villain who is basically attempting to destabilize or take over some place or some people. So that's a political move. That's, you know, kind of what we call imperialism. And then in the response comes from a superhero who tries to usually stop this sort of takeover and return the place or the people to a, quote, status quo situation. And one of the issues with superheroes is that they're not elected. They are powered by superpowers that they either got accidentally or that they were born with in some capacity. And they operate in a certain sense in a political space because they're protecting a people or a nation or a group in some way from some sort of threat. And so one of the issues around superheroes is that they are fundamentally vigilantes.
And that, to me, is maybe why I don't always make the connection to politics. They seem inherently lawless. But as you dissect the films, that's not really the case. We do see these kinds of checks and balances in a way, in these different spheres. There's a lot in the book. It would be hard to get into each kind of piece of it. What do you think would be most surprising for listeners about the ways in which these films engage in this political conversation?
Well, I mean, I think the sort of largest section of the book that we found really interesting as the chapters were rolling in from the authors, of course, takes up a lot of different dimensions of what we would consider to be identity politics. And so we have a lot of exploration of tensions around gender and sex and the lack of sort of representation also with regard to LGBTQ characters that are so prevalent in the comic books themselves. But there's also a lot of understanding of or thinking about superheroes as people who are disabled in a certain sense because they are abled differently. And so if you do have, you know, sort of all the power of the universe as Captain Marvel may have that makes you abled differently. So you are not necessarily disabled in a standard way of thinking about it, but you are also sort of hampered by your capacities to do things that normal people can, normal in quotes, people can do in their day-to-day lives. And then, of course, somebody like Tony Stark, who doesn't have sort of physical superpowers, but created his suit so that he has superpowers. And we have a number of authors who talk about sort of his trauma and how this is one of the things that spurs him forward to sort of superpower himself. So these are, again, these are sort of identity questions and understandings of representation, masculinity and femininity presentations. You know, those are one side of politics. I would say on the other side of politics is this question of, you know, how do you govern superheroes? You know, that was a really big part of phases 1 through 3 of the Marvel Cinematic Universe film series. You know, sort of having the Avengers and then having them make mistakes and having people who died as a result of the things that they did and then having an attempt at a kind of supranational way of managing them. And of course, having superheroes not want to be managed by governmental institutions.
It seems like when we look at that aspect of it in particular, the correlations become pretty clear. You go, oh, I have seen this play out in our real world. When people watch these films, and this is a hard question to get to, are they making these connections either explicitly, like understanding that, or is there this kind of subconscious connection to our real world?
Well, we are moving towards a second volume where we're actually going to survey individuals who have seen the films to ask them questions about some of these issues. So it's hard to get at that information without asking directly what people think that they are seeing and understanding when they see a film. But popular culture in general is conveying all kinds of narratives to us that we enjoy sort of watching in a spectacle on the big screen, or we sit down in our living rooms and watch on television, that are conveying all kinds of components of politics that we may not necessarily say, oh, that is political. But we are being immersed in a narrative that talks about things that is, in fact, engaging in a sort of political discourse that we will then sort of perhaps reflect on as we think about the film, think about the television show, talk about it with our friends, perhaps read about it online. And so all of those components, I think, are part of what popular culture and something like superheroic films and television shows convey to us.
If you're just tuning in, this is Lake Effect. I'm speaking with Lily Gorin. She is one of the authors of The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, as someone who is a little divorced from the Marvel Cinematic Universe myself, I've seen some of the films, but, you know, I'm certainly not a comic book reader. I will say I have always had the impression that these were films made for and by white men. As you go through the book, that becomes very clear that it is a much more complicated narrative in these films. And something that really surprised me was the information on who's watching these films, the audience that is really engaging in this material. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, this was a chapter in particular by Bethany Lacina, and it was really, really fascinating to read that the tickets that are bought, particularly by the population in the United States, are African-American ticket buyers, both men and women. And so that in comparison to sort of white ticket buyers, the films in general, and we're not talking just about Black Panther or Wakanda Forever, but all of the Marvel cinematic films like Thor and Iron Man and so forth, that these have a real appeal to a diverse audience. And as a result of that, it is, again, like who is watching the films becomes very interesting in terms of also who's making the films. And this is, again, something that we've seen recently with the Oscars and the fact that there were no female directors who were nominated for an Academy Award this year, as in so many years. And that there are often very few Black individuals, either African-American or from other countries, who are nominated as directors or even writing credits and so forth. So that, you know, Oscars so white and production so white is still an issue. The Marvel Cinematic Universe has been sort of talking about pushing forward with more representation, more diversity, both in front of the camera and behind the camera. You've seen sort of a little bit more of that on television, where the sort of ratings numbers aren't always as clear as the ticket sale numbers with regard to big box office hits or attempts at hits. And so I think that who the audience is, who the perceived audience is, by consumers in general, but also by the studio and also by its parent company, Disney, are keys to part of what the Marvel Cinematic Universe is also trying to present as its brand.
Going through the book, especially as someone who is a little on the outside of this, I think the thing I was most struck by was honestly just the power of this universe to some extent. The power it has giving people an emotional connection to these, you know, fictional characters, but also in shaping opinions, shaping views on right and wrong and how we want our world to play out, I guess. What we think is right for government controls, these things that really govern our lives. What do you think the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe looks like, given its audience, given its stated goals? Do we see this as a universe that continues on a, for lack of a better word, kind of progressive outlook of politics? Or do we think, given, you know, its masters to some extent, a large corporation and the desire to make more and more money, do we think that could change?
Well, my co-author Nick Carnes and I, also with Bethany Lacina, had a piece in the Washington Post around the time that Wakanda Forever came out that really focused in on this question of whether the MCU was too woke, because this was something that was coming up in some commentary about, you know, what the MCU was presenting, who the heroes were and what did they look like, and what ultimately were the narratives that were components of not only Wakanda Forever, but, you know, some of the other films that have come out under Phase 4 and moving into Phase 5. And so we've seen more diverse casts. We've seen stories that are positioned sort of less in the West and to some degree more in the East. And of course, Wakanda Forever takes up a Mesoazteca group who lives underwater. And then, of course, we have Wakanda, which is an African country that nobody knew existed for a very long time, that, you know, is sort of very futuristic and incredibly wealthy and competent. And so you have these contrasting societies that we are looking at with our sort of westernized eyes. But part of what superhero films generally do is exercise a kind of conservative small c approach, which is to sort of keep what was good. And so in that context, I think that there is, you know, Disney wants to make money, MCU wants to make money. So they very gingerly oftentimes step forward into realms that may be more controversial. And so the question, again, of representation of LGBTQ characters has been really kind of quiet, both in television and in film. And this is something that fans have been asking for and fans have kind of been demanding. And this is so prevalent in the comic books, but it hasn't quite been translated into big screen or even to the little screen. So that there is still some of the small C conservative narrative that is definitely embedded in what superheroes usually are doing.
It'll be interesting to see how the MCU evolves. Lily, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to talk to you again, Joy.
Dr. Lily Gorin is an author and editor of the book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll bring you WUWM's latest election roundtable, where a group of Democratic-leaning voters respond to the shakeup in the presidential race. Plus, Chirp Chat explores how new buildings are being made safer for birds. Join us tomorrow at noon for Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.